Welcome to For the Long Run, the podcast exploring the why behind what keeps runners running long, strong, and motivated. I'm your host, Jonathan Levitt. Through personal and professional connections in the running world, I have the privilege of getting to know some amazing athletes. I've always been fascinated by the psychological aspect of running, and this podcast is aimed at exploring this and much more. I hope you enjoy. This episode is sponsored by Atoday. I've been loving their BioZoom, a portable myofascial release device, essentially a massage therapy gun. In these times when I'm not able to see my chiropractor for ART or other manual therapies, the BioZoom definitely hits the spot, pun intended, of course. BioZoom is designed to help with recovery and can target specific areas of the body in different ways with one of the five attachments designed for tissue-specific treatments. Quieter than the other therapy guns out there, I love using mine while sitting on the couch relaxing, or honestly, even while on a Zoom call. You can get your own at Atoday.com and use the code FTLR15, that's 15, to save 15%. Welcome back. I have Courtney DeWalter joining me today on the podcast. Courtney, thanks so much for taking some time to chat here.
Yeah, good morning.
Morning. So first question is a tough one. Who is who is Courtney?
Oh, geez. What?
Right off the bat.
Yeah, where do you even go with that? I'm just trying to enjoy life as much as possible and get the most out of it that I can. So that kind of guides most things that I do.
That's awesome. And you do that by running some pretty long distances. So my first question, or I guess my second question is, do you remember your first run?
Like ever?
Yeah.
I remember in elementary school, we would run the mile out around the field area. So that was probably one of my first runs.
What do you remember about those days?
I remember loving it. I grew up playing a lot of sports. We were a really big soccer family. And so, you know, that was always being active and running were always part of my life. But just the peer running motion and you know, not necessarily chasing a soccer ball down a field, but like being able to just focus on pushing yourself, I remember liking a lot.
That's awesome. So you've gone in that time, you've gone from the mile around some grass fields to 200 miles plus. Where did that evolution come from? And where did you get the urge to, or when did you get the urge to, run longer distances than what your peers might have been doing?
It sort of snowball affected, and now the snowball is pretty big, but
rolling downhill quickly.
Yeah. After college, I was just wanting something to train for, and I was curious about that marathon distance. And so I did a few road marathons, and was really surprised to survive them. Like I thought 26.2 miles would kill me. And when it didn't, I think I just wondered, you know, what's the next thing that sounds too crazy to do, but that I could actually survive if I just tried it. And that led me to the ultra running world where, really quickly a 50K finish turns into trying 50 miles, which, you know, just leads you to those 200 plus ones.
So I spoke with a woman named Jackie on this podcast who is an amputee. And so she runs trails and ultras with a prosthetic. So she's going down mountains and doing all these amazing things with one real leg and one prosthetic leg. And what she said was, when somebody says you can't do that, or that's crazy, or why would you do that? Like that stokes her fire and challenges her to actually do it and prove people wrong. Do you feel that there's some of that with you, that, you know, you committed to the Colorado Trail? It's almost 500 miles. You do Tahoe 200. And is there an element of like, this is crazy? So, or other people think it's crazy, so I want to do it.
That's super inspiring of Jackie. I'll have to listen to that podcast. But for me, none of it is external or what other people are saying. So that doesn't light my fire to have someone tell me I can't do it or that it's too crazy to do. Like, that has nothing to do with what my like drive comes from, I don't think. I think I'm more curious internally, like what's possible and, you know, what can we try and, you know, what could help me get that next distance thing. So like figuring out all of those puzzle pieces. And it's just kind of been a natural evolution of, you know, doing one thing. So finishing a 200 miler made me realize that it's possible. And now I want to see what that next thing could be. And so just continuing to look for that for myself. But it's never, the fire's never lit by someone telling me I can't do something. That's not the driver for me ever.
That's awesome. Has 2020 reaffirmed all of that for you and showed you that it really is that internal, you know, I'm going to be better than I was yesterday. Cause I feel like, so this podcast is aimed at exploring the why, and 2020 has forced everybody to explore their why.
Yeah.
People who are you know, externally motivated and need to race seem to be in a more challenging spot than someone like yourself who, you know, you just want to see what you can do and where, you know, where your legs can take you. Right.
Yeah. I think, this year has for sure affirmed that, where I just love running. And so I haven't really experienced like a dip in motivation, or I haven't had trouble getting out the door every day, even when I didn't know what I was training for, because I love it so much. And it's all helping me build those blocks together that will, you know, maybe let me explore a farther distance or see what's possible for my brain on a new level. So it's been a crazy year, but I've found it to be pretty fun for just training and adventuring.
That's awesome. Yeah, I love it. I think one of the things that I like most about running is sort of what you've described. It's the, you know, you look back on what used to be hard and it's now attainable, or it's now like, yeah, I could do that. And the miles that used to be your peak weeks are now maybe your normal. And I think that's one of the coolest things about running that can be extrapolated into life. Like, the more you do hard things, the easier other hard things become.
Yeah, exactly. It's so cool. And you don't even notice it. It's like those tiny things every single day just suddenly a year later have added up to something kind of substantial, and that's pretty cool.
Definitely. Yeah, it's that, as you said, building blocks or putting blocks together, and over the long run it adds up into something nice. So you've sort of alluded to your why. Camelia Mayfield was curious. She wanted to hear more specifically, what would you say it is?
My why for running?
Yeah.
I think I'm just curious what's possible, and like every time I do a longer distance, it makes me realize that these limits we set for ourselves are way too low, and we need to raise the bar to actually see what's possible. And so exploring physically and mentally what we can do if we invest ourselves in something has been really fun for me.
What do you focus on when you're deep into a long distance and you still have, you know, a marathon to go or two marathons to go or, you know, 100 miles to go? Where does your head take you?
I try and stay in the moment and not get overwhelmed by what's left, but just try and move as efficiently as possible in that section that I'm in right there. So, you know, taking what the trail gives me, taking what my body cues are giving me, and being as efficient as possible with just that part, and then leaving that part behind and moving on to the next section once I'm in it. So that, you know, if the last section went terribly, then, you know, that's just how it went and there's no need to dwell on it. But now we take on this section and we do it again and we try and be efficient again.
So it's like compartmentalizing each block.
Kind of, and just not fretting about about what's happened, you know, like accepting the reality of how it's gone so far. And then taking this next one with kind of like a fresh attitude of, well, this next section, you know, here we are right now. So let's do this part as well as we can.
And how does the sleep deprivation play into that? That's definitely, you know, a variable that many people aren't familiar with.
Well, I still have a lot to learn about the sleep deprivation game and how to do it better. So that's a pretty fun puzzle piece for me right now. But
is it something you like train, or is it just muscle memory? The more you do it, the more you can tolerate it.
Yeah. Well, I'm no expert and I haven't been training it. Mostly I'm just trying to rely on, you know, all those 100-mile plus things that take more than a day to help me learn more about what my body does when it's in those states of fatigue, and then how I can make sure I'm physically still moving forward efficiently when I'm in that state. So yeah, I haven't quite nailed it yet though.
What does it feel like when you're, you know, 60 hours into something and you haven't slept?
Yeah, it's kind of cool. Like, I don't know. I've grown to appreciate that feeling because it means you're getting to do something that's, you know, a multi-day effort. That's pretty special. So, but it also feels like kind of foggy, like time is this weird warp where, you're never really sure what time it is. It's just either dark out or light out. And then, my brain will start playing tricks on me for sure. So I'll hallucinate, or in this past, Colorado Trail effort, I was experiencing this really intense deja vu for a long time. So it's always interesting to just try to notice the things happening. And like in the moment, I'm usually too tired to explain it to anyone or even really process it, but I just kind of file it away in my brain as like, here's an experience you're having right now at this hour of running, and it you know, afterwards is hopefully helping me learn from it and then get better for the next one.
That makes sense, I guess. I'll take your word for it.
Nothing about it makes sense.
So, yeah. That's one way to put it. So you mentioned the Colorado Trail. Do you want to talk a little bit about why you chose that as an FKT attempt, and we'll go from there?
Happy to talk about it. Yeah, I live in Colorado, so that's probably an important detail. And it's a 500-mile single-track trail from Durango to Denver. So you cross quite a few mountain ranges. You go through all these wilderness areas, and it's absolutely beautiful. And for me, when I finished Moab, which is 240 miles, it kind of triggered the snowball to keep rolling, where I just wondered, you know, if you can survive this many miles, then what's the next level that you could try? And 500 seemed kind of logical for whatever reason. When it happened that the Colorado Trail was 500 miles and here I am living in Colorado, it became the natural thing that just tugged on my imagination for the past few years of what that would be like to try it. So when all races were canceled this summer, it became kind of an obvious choice of a project to attempt.
What were you thinking about as your crew was cracking beers at the start and you were, you know, taking off on this 500-mile journey?
I was thinking that I was glad they were quenching their thirst and that I was excited to...
They had a very important job.
They did. Yeah, that was huge. We had to figure out, you know, like, do you crack them on three? Do you, you know, like the timing of it was really important. But... I was excited to just start running. I was excited to get on the trail. I had no pacer with me for those first 20 miles. And so I was pumped to, you know, just settle into a groove and wrap my head around that we were starting this thing and it was really happening and that I was headed to Denver with my feet and to just enjoy some peaceful hours out there.
And how did the first 100 miles go?
The first 100 went pretty well. I think the first, I would say like 60 went really well. And then it got hot out and I was in the San Juans and I, you basically spend like all day above tree line. So it's a huge section that kind of bops up between 11,000 and 13,000 feet, just up and down for a really long time. And so I got kind of toasted during that section, which was, I guess, from 60 to 90-ish miles or so. So first 100 went smoothly, but I definitely remember feeling like, ooh, these are signals that are like, I mean, you still have 400 miles to go, so like maybe ease off. And that's when we decided to like kind of slow the pace in the daytime when it was so hot and exposed and try and take advantage of the nighttime hours when it was cooling down a lot.
So help me understand, like, again, how I know you said you compartmentalize it and you focus on the section that's ahead of you, but I'm struggling to understand how you do that when I'm rectifying that with, like, that's almost two months of running for me. how do you like reconcile that?
I think it was just putting myself in a mental state of patience and playing the long game. And so there was a section, I think around like mile 90, where I was like fire hose vomiting out in the San Juans. And then it was like, okay, that's fine because we're playing a long game right now and like throwing up here in day one, that's fine. We've got many days ahead to roller coaster our way through this. So a lot of times, like with whatever pacer I was with, it would be just framing it and remembering, hey, we're playing the long game. So right now you're walking because this section is, you know, eating you alive, but that's fine. It's a long game and we're headed to Denver. So
I think
it was a mental framing.
Yeah. I think that's another piece where there are a lot of takeaways for amateurs to understand, like that's both a micro way to look at running and a macro way to look at it. Like, any one specific data point is, I don't want to say useless, but like focusing too much on one thing is probably wasted mental effort, where if you miss a day here or if you puke, you know, projectile vomiting for a couple hours there in the long run or for the long run, it's about, as you said, stacking the bricks and step after step after step. So I think I appreciate that take because, again, I think that that's the kind of stuff that can be extrapolated to somebody like myself or many of the people listening, where we might not go out and run 500 miles and or attempt to run 500 miles in a single go, but there are things that you did and there are ways that you approached it that we all can learn from.
Yeah, exactly. It's all the same, 5K or 500 miles when you break it down to those tiny pieces. It's doing the same thing. And I think anyone can be, you know, pushing themselves to go just, you know, one more kilometer or one more lap around their block or and add up those building blocks.
So when did or how did the decision to seek medical help happen on that journey?
Yeah. So a couple days in, my breathing was labored and I was wheezing and having really productive coughs, which was different than I had ever experienced. I had had like dry coughs during a dusty race before or a high altitude adventure, but never something so productive that was causing such wheezing as well. And so my crew just started kind of tuning into that and, you know, they were reaching out when they had cell service to different resources to try and, you know, help them diagnose how urgent this was, or if it was a problem, or what we could do to try and solve it. And it just kept getting worse. And it was preventing me on those last days from sleeping at all, even though I was so exhausted, and sleep would have really helped a lot. Because every time I stopped to rest, I just sat there coughing and wheezing the whole time. So it was kind of like causing this negative domino effect. And when I got to mile 309, they advised that I rest for a few hours, which was not, you know, what I had in my plan of what I should be doing, which was to keep running. But then I stopped to rest, and while I was laying there trying to sleep, it was just constant coughing and this like rattling kind of wet wheeze happening. And so then we were only 20 minutes from the Leadville hospital, and my crew decided to go get checked out there while we had this convenience and while it was, you know, causing so many negative things. So I'm very thankful that they had their heads on straight and that they were paying attention, because it turned out to be a very good call that they made.
Where were you mentally when it was advised that you do something you didn't want to do there?
The sleeping or the hospital?
Both, or just stopping.
Yeah. Well, so going into the effort, the crew of people that I had with me were all people who have, you know, done ultras and been a part of my crew before. And I trusted 100% to keep the goal in mind of like, I want to push it to Denver, but also to keep my health in mind. So before the effort, I told them, you know, in those later days, I 100% trust you guys and I default to your choices. So that's like a non-negotiable. I won't question you if you tell me to do something. And so when I rolled into 309 miles and I said, I want to keep going, and they said, sleep, then you'll keep going more successfully. I was like, okay, we'll sleep. Let's do this. So that wasn't a question. And then when they told me we were going to the ER, I definitely needed a little justification of like, why right now? The wheezing and coughing to me seemed like it just was part of it. You know, I was like, I was going to take that wheeze all the way to Denver. and so when they, you know, explained their thought process to me a little bit, then it was like, okay, we'll get in the car and we'll go to the ER. But part of me was holding on to this idea that when I got to the ER, I was going to describe to this doctor what I was doing, and he was going to say, or she was going to say, well, that's just normal. You're running for a really long ways. Go ahead and continue. Like, so
thinking back on that now, do you think a doctor ever would have said that?
I know. Well, that's the problem. My only hope was it was Leadville Hospital. And so they had experience with altitude and with,
you know, it was an ultra marathon.
Yeah. I was like, maybe, you know, I can hold on to this thread of hope. But really quickly, that became untrue and not possible. And so then it was just accepting the situation. But yeah, I was hoping he'd say, well, of course you're breathing like that. You've been running for so long. Go on out and keep enjoying it.
Don't waste so much time in here. Get on. But unfortunately, it didn't go that way.
Correct.
How long did it? How long was there any sort of post run blues that you had from that?
I was really lucky where my parents and my husband were off work for that whole week, and my parents were in town. You know, because we had been planning to be running still. So once I got out of the hospital, I got to just spend time with them. And, you know, we don't talk about running. They love me no matter what the result is. And so we got to, you know, just enjoy each other's company and enjoy life a little bit. And I think that helped a lot. And then I think it was never like a post-run blues, but just like a kind of keeping it in the fact zone of here are the facts of what happened. here's how that played out. And now here's what I can take from it to do this again. And really ending up in the hospital at 309 miles versus cracking a beer at 490 miles has just like lit the fire even more for me of, man, I want to try that again and see if I can get all the way to Denver next time. So that's awesome. Been kind of cool. Yeah.
Did you have any hallucinations or what hallucinations do you remember from the first couple hundred miles?
I for sure did. I saw a circle of these giant brown bear teddy bears hugging, which looked so cozy.
Are you sure those weren't gummy bears?
No gummy bears were involved in that hallucination. And then I also vividly remember, like, it was nighttime and I wasn't sweating. It was pretty cold during the nights, but I leaned over and I had these sweat droplets of pomegranate seeds just falling off of my forehead, which was really strange. But I would say the strangest mind game was the deja vu that I got stuck in, where for a solid 24 hours, I was certain I was just reliving everything that was happening. Like all the sections of trail I already knew before I got to them. All the conversations with pacers were things that we had already talked about. And it was really strange. I had never had that before.
So I read, the pomegranate sweat is fascinating. what do you think about when you experience that? Do you have to like say, no, this can't possibly be happening, or does it actually feel real?
I mean, it looks really vivid and real, but I know now that I'm, you know, into hallucination zone. So usually when they're happening, I'm so exhausted that I can't communicate them to whoever's with me. I can't describe them when I'm seeing them, but they just get kind of like shoved in a bin in my brain of, here are the friends you made while you were out there.
Bears and pomegranates. I read an article that was, I think, titled 200s Are the New 100. And in it, there was a line that said, it was talked about going up in distance. And in it, there was a line that said, in a marathon, you have a bad spot that could be a few miles. In a 100-miler, you have a bad spot that could be a few hours. But in a 200-miler, you could have a bad spot that could last a few days. Yeah. So what would you say to somebody who is looking to step up in distance or looking to do something beyond anything they've ever done before?
I'd say go for it, 100%. Give it a try. There's nothing to lose. And it's really cool to surprise yourself and to see that you could do this thing that sounded impossible.
Cool. Thanks again to Addaday for sponsoring this episode. I love their massage therapy gun called BioZoom, especially in these days when I can't see my chiro for regular body work. BioZoom is designed to help with recovery and can target any specific sore spots with one of the 5 attachments designed for different parts of the body. It's super easy to use right out of the box and has definitely helped with any muscular aches and pains that have popped up over the last few months. Grab yours at Addaday.com, like Add a Day, with code FTLR15 to save 15%. So you talked about your crew and how you have unwavering support of them and them of you. I've seen you crewing. I've seen you supporting your husband in some of his races. So you've been on both sides of that equation. What sort of recommendations do you have for somebody who might be crewing or pacing an ultra for the first time?
Oh my gosh. Yeah. Crewing's so fun. It's so hard. Like I think it's harder than doing the race usually, but I think it's so rewarding to be on a team with someone who's, you know, attempting this big goal and they want to, you know, surpass their expectations of what's possible, and to be part of that team to help them is really special. So if you're going to do that, you're a critical part. Like being being on that team. It might not be your legs that run the distance, but you are really important in helping them finish, and to just try and be positive and be in a problem solving mode all the time to help them get to that end goal.
Yeah, I love that. And so I've been to Western States a couple times, and I crewed a friend at Run Rabbit, and to see the just like selflessness that is on display at aid stations in the middle of the woods and all this stuff. I mean, there's really nothing like it.
Yeah. I mean, crews are usually sleeping as little or, you know, almost as little as the runner. And they're the ones wiping vomit from faces or dealing with nasty feet or whatever. So it's really amazing to have friends and family like that who are willing to, you know, do these non-glamorous things to help you reach a new distance, a new finish line.
Definitely. So many of the finish lines you've been a part of, you've gotten to faster than anybody else in the race, men and women. What is that like?
I like to compete for sure. I love to race. And when I'm racing, I'm going to just keep looking for the next person always because it helps me push harder. But mm-hmm. I'm always making sure when I finish a race, I have left every ounce of myself out there and gave it everything I had that day. And whether that lands me at the front of the pack or not is less important to me than giving it everything I have.
That's a refreshingly different take. So when did you realize that being a professional ultra runner was a possibility?
I think I'm still pinching myself that this is my life right now. But I think, so I was teaching and, teaching takes a lot of hours of a day and training for these longer races. I wanted to dedicate a lot of hours of the day and suddenly, you know, it was like, well, where are these hours coming from? And, so my husband and I just decided to like, let's try this ultra running thing for me full time and see what's possible so that when we're 90 years old and we're sitting there reflecting on life, we don't wonder what if we had gone all in on that. So that was just kind of a choice to jump all in on it. And since then I've been able to, work with really wonderful companies and I'm trying to just do this full time for as long as that ride lasts.
And how do you maintain and manage the sponsorship side of it?
What do you mean?
So many, many people who listen to this podcast enjoy sort of the behind the scenes look at how or what makes professional ultra running possible. You have a shoe sponsor or an apparel sponsor or a hydration or nutrition or something like that that helps make what you're doing possible on a full-time basis. And so I think people like to learn sort of the I don't want to say the secrets behind it, but like what is that relationship like for you in terms of social media and how you use brands and how you work with brands, probably a better way to put it, to allow you to continue to do this pursuit of excellence.
Yeah, so I'm lucky enough to be working with really amazing companies, and all of those partnerships sort of started organically, where it was things I was already using and loving, and then I was able to connect with those companies and work out a way to make it so I could, you know, live this lifestyle and continue to race and look for my limits of what's possible. So, it's pretty cool. Like you get to test things a lot of times. So, helping, you know, develop maybe the next line of, shoes or of, you know, Tailwind nutrition products or whatever it is. And, that's been really special and like I said, I'm pinching myself every day that I'm able to live this life right now. It's pretty cool.
Awesome. So, when you mentioned, when you look back at when you're 90 years old and you say you didn't leave anything in the tank and you took all these risks, what are you going to be really, really, really proud of?
The relationships with people and the memories made with people, I think.
Hopefully. To me more about that. what does community mean to you?
It's all of it. For me, that's, I mean, I'm trying to live life and enjoy it as much as possible. And so to build these memories and relationships with friends and family along the way, I mean, that's what you have at the end of it is those moments and those people. And that's the cool part for me. So I don't think we'll be sitting on our rocking chairs, like talking about any medals or podiums. We'll be remembering, you know, that crazy adventure we did with so-and-so. And when we turned off our headlamps in the night and, you know, saw shooting stars or whatever. I hope it's that kind of stuff.
I love that. I was at Broken Arrow last year, and at the start of it, the race director said something along those lines, and essentially, when you're taking your last breaths and your clocks, you know, run out, I'm getting the chills thinking of this sentence. You're not going to remember, you know, what you said. You're going to remember, meaning like the medals and podiums and whatnot. You'll remember the people, the mountains, and epic days. Pushing your limits and doing it with amazing people around you. And I butchered that quote, but that's the essence of it. And
yeah, exactly.
And I think that's for the people that are able to do this for a long time. I think that's what it comes down to. So I've done over 100 podcasts with people like yourself and elite athletes and professional athletes. And it's really cool to see that as a consistent, takeaway that people don't really give a shit about the outcome. It's the process and the experience and the people that experience it with you along the way.
Yeah.
That's what matters. And again, that's a consistent theme amongst professional athletes and Olympians and very high performing people. And it's interesting. I asked that same question to a woman on the Bowerman Track Club, Vanessa Fraser. And I said, I didn't say 90. I said, in 10 years, you know, what are you going to look back and be really proud of? And she said, I don't know, just getting better. And this is, again, somebody whose job it is to compete and train and show up. And so I think that, like, hearing that from someone like yourself and many other people is really reaffirming to amateurs who often focus on, tangible goal-oriented outcomes. So for you, has it always been that way, or has there ever been a time when you were more focused on metrics or objective measures of success?
I, as far as like just thinking right now on the spot about it, I think it's always been that way. Where for sure I want to do my best and you know, if I'm going to do something, I want to, you know, give it everything I have. But then after that, it's like less about what happened and more about
how it happened.
Yeah, exactly.
Cool. What are you scared of? Besides pomegranates.
Yeah. Well, one thing I'm scared of is birds that swoop towards my head, like during the spring when they're building their nests. I feel like they look at my hair like the perfect nesting material. And I'm scared of I think losing people probably.
Talk to me more about that one.
I mean, I think it just kind of like relates back to what we were just talking about, where people and those memories built together are huge for me. And so when you lose the people, then you don't get the chance to make more of those memories together.
Definitely. Switching gears a little bit, do you do anything around mental training or mental preparation?
Not consciously in my training runs. I'm sure, like, you know, tiny blocks get added during training runs sometimes, but it's never like, this is a mental training day. My hope is that all of the racing and all of those tough experiences during some of those longer efforts help me in growing the bigger blocks of the mental training piece.
That's awesome. So I've heard a bit about your training. It's different than most, you could say. So talk to me about that, and how do you make decisions around training?
Yeah, my training is pretty flexible. I don't follow a plan. I don't know every single day what workout I'm going to do, but each morning while I drink my coffee, I kind of assess the system. So like, how are my legs? How's my brain? You know, where am I at emotionally? And then that helps me gauge what kind of day it might be for a run. But even when I leave the door, sometimes I'll have done that body check and I'll have, you know, made kind of a plan for where I'm running or what I'm doing. And then I'll leave the house and it's still fluid, where things can change while I'm on the run as well. But I'll have an idea of like what race is coming up, for an example, or what my calendar looks like for the next few weeks. And so I'll know going into a week if it's a week where the foot's on the gas the whole time, or a week where I'm, you know, a little lighter, or somewhere in between there. So it's flexible each day, but I'll usually know what kind of week it might be just based on what's coming up.
Got it. How much, how far in the future have you considered for the rest of 2020?
Just this next cup of coffee, really.
What's in it? No. What's in the coffee? What kind of coffee?
A little French vanilla creamer always, but
nice.
Or there's a really great Cinnamon Toast Crunch creamer that's out. It's fantastic.
That's the best cereal.
It is the best cereal, hands down. So try the creamer sometime if you're a coffee guy.
Definitely. Back over to nutrition. What are you fueling with on some of these longer events?
Always Tailwind, Honey Stinger waffles and chews, and mashed potatoes.
Just those three?
Yeah. So if it's 100 miles or less, it's just those three. If it gets up into the 200 plus range, then it's those three things plus basically any other carb that sounds good. So quesadillas, pancakes, pierogies, pizza, any of those easy eating things to just like, I don't know, I get pretty hungry when it becomes a multi-day effort.
As I imagine would happen. How does racing in America versus Europe compare for you?
Oh man. I haven't done tons of racing in Europe, but just the experiences I've had, it's always like a lot bigger of a thing, where, you know, the local towns all know about it. So all the people are out cheering and the aid stations are big, and usually the number of people in the race are big, so everything just feels like a little bit amplified when racing over there.
Cool. And then in terms of terrain, how do you train for something like UTMB living in Colorado?
So I've done UTMB one time, and I would say the training I did for it was pretty irregular that summer. I mostly was on a bike because I was recovering from injury. But in theory, we're lucky enough to have a lot of mountains here in Colorado where you could, you know, kind of mimic the grade and some of the terrain by just getting above tree line here. So ideally, if I was training for something like UTMB, I would spend a lot of time power hiking and just practicing the downhills here in the Colorado mountains.
What are some of your favorite spots in the area?
In Colorado?
Yeah.
I love the Leadville area. So the whole Sawatch Range, the Collegiate Peaks through there, and then just tons of cool trails to explore that aren't above treeline as well. It's got a lot of things going.
Nice. I've spent a decent amount of time out in Colorado, but haven't explored much further out than Boulder and Golden.
Okay.
But right in your backyard, I've punished myself on North Table Mountain on that first climb a few times.
Nice.
It's a nice Golden, way to start a run.
Yeah. Golden's got some really fun trails to run. So you'll have to try some on the west side of town next time, not those tables.
Yes. Yeah, I've been out in a little bit further west of Boulder, but I need to go much further west, I feel.
Yeah, yeah.
What do you wish people knew about you?
I have no idea.
Sometimes people are like, I play piano, or, you know, I have this strange, somebody said, I'm not as mean as I look.
Oh, geez.
I think that was my favorite response.
Yeah. I'm not sure. I feel like people know quite a bit, so I'm not sure what I wish they knew in addition to that.
Awesome. Well, thank you so much for chatting today. Where can we follow you, find you and follow you if you want to follow along with your journey?
Yeah. Thank you so much. You can find me on Instagram at Courtney Duolter, at Court Duolter on Twitter, and then on Facebook just as Courtney Duolter.
Awesome. Thanks so much.
Yeah, thank you. Have a good one.
Of course. That's it for today's episode. Like many long runs, it's sad when it has to end. I hope you join in next week on For the Long Run. And in the meantime, happy trails. If you've enjoyed this episode, it would mean a lot to me if you shared it so that others can find it and enjoy it too.